Today is July 16th, 2012. This is Desiree Hargis working on behalf of the H.J. Letcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Kayala O'Sullivan Watson over the phone about her experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Kayala, can you begin with your full name?
Yes, my full legal name is Rachel Kayala Onapua O'Sullivan.
And when and where were you born?
I was born in Hawaii on the island of Oahu in 1950.
And can you tell us a little bit about your childhood and your early athletic pursuits?
Very early on, I was very active in just anything that required some movement. And when I lived in Hawaii, we live what we call the country. And there were, we did a lot of swimming, a lot of hiking, and just a lot of activity. I really wasn't aware of what was going on around me, so because we didn't have a TV, and there were no cell phones back then either. But I learned to swim in the ocean and do all those other kind of things. In fact, I never saw a swimming pool until I was 8 years old, when my father brought me into town in Honolulu, and we went by the YMCA, and I saw a pool, and I didn't know what it was. And I said, "What's that?" And he goes, "It's a pool." And he says, "What are you looking for?" I says, "I'm looking for the fish, you know." And he said, "No, there's no fish here." So that was kind of like my first exposure to a pool. And there was more or less a diving board, but it was more like a plank, which was kind of interesting to me as well. I had more energy than my mother wanted me to, so she put me in trampoline and gymnastics just to tire me out. I don't think it helped, but my early years up until sixth grade, that's pretty much what I did. Before I started diving a little bit, I started in the sixth grade about twice a week. And then about the seventh grade, the coach at the school I was at said, "You know, you look pretty coordinated. Why don't you come a little more often, like about 4 days a week?" I said, "Oh, okay." So I came about 4 days a week, and that was about seventh grade. About the eighth grade, he was saying, "Well, you're getting pretty good. We should probably take it up a notch." And I said, "Okay." And about the ninth grade, and I think it was about the eighth grade that I went to my first junior nationals in Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska. And I won the 1 in 3 meter, which qualified me for outdoor nationals. So I went to outdoor nationals in 1965 when I was in the eighth grade.
And where were those held?
That was the outdoor nationals was in Maumee, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
It was difficult, and it was interesting because they had a diving board that I had never dove on, because we just sort of had a plank back at home. And there was a really springy diving board, which I couldn't catch the rhythm of that board. So, and my coach kept yelling at me, and I kept saying, "I don't know what to do. You know, it's weird. It actually bends." I was used to just pounding on it and jumping as hard as I could. But I did okay there. I took the 1 meter, I came in 13th, and 3 meter, I was 20th. But I had only been diving 3 meter for about 6 months before that, because we didn't have any 3 meter diving boards in Hawaii. So I had to go onto an army base to practice on there. So we did that about once or twice a week. And for about 6 months, and then off we went to junior nationals and nationals. And then from there, I just started going to nationals.
Well, how was the journey, the flight all the way from Hawaii out to Nebraska and Ohio?
Well, from Honolulu to California is about 4 to 5 hours, 4.5 to 5 hours. Mm-hmm. And then from there to Nebraska is about another 3 hours. And then from Nebraska on to Ohio is about another 5-6 hours.
Wow.
So it was a long journey. And by the time I reached Ohio, I was saying, "Okay, I'm done. You know, I'm really tired." You know, and I wasn't used to the weather, because we have very temperate weather here.
Mm-hmm.
Anywhere it goes from 70 to 85 all year long. You know, it doesn't vary very much. When I was in Ohio, when I was there, it was like 55, you know, when we were training. And then the day of the meet, it went up to like 85, 90. And I think it just wiped everybody out, not only me. But by then I was just like, okay, I'm tired. You know, I don't think I can do this anymore. And we hadn't really planned on going to outdoors, only unless I did really well at Junior Nationals. And when I went to Junior Nationals, my coach couldn't come, so my father came. And so I just sort of coached myself when I was there because he couldn't make it. And he said, well, if you do good, then I'll come up and then we'll go to Ohio. I said, oh, okay, that sounds fine. So I thought I was going home after Nebraska.
Oh.
And he said, no, we're going to go on further because you automatically qualified. I went, oh, okay. So off we went to Ohio. And I think I wasn't, you know, I had peaked, I think, at Nebraska. So by the time I hit Ohio, I was coming down.
Oh.
You know. But it was interesting. That was the most kids I ever dove against, you know, because in Hawaii, there was only like 2-3 kids I dove against. So going to nationals where you had, you know, 20-30 people was a pretty huge experience for me. It was pretty big eye opener.
Definitely.
And my style was quite different from everybody else. So I didn't even look like everybody else. And maybe that's why I stood out. I'm not sure.
How was your style different from everybody else's?
I think because we lived in Honolulu, I couldn't copy anybody, you know, because a lot of times when you see other styles or you're diving, you kind of pick up here and there from what other people are doing. And my coach's style, it was pretty much relegated to the board I was on. There was no bounce. So your arm swing was different. My hurdle was different. So when I got up there and there was a diving board that was pretty springy, I thought, wow, I don't know what to do with this. You know, I had to change my arm swing and my timing and all that while I was there. So when we came back in 65, he said, you know, we got to get another board. So when you go up there, you can, you know, you'll be ready. Cause I had to try and adjust to the board when I got there. So I think it was until like the ending of 66 that we were able to we had to buy our own board.
Oh, wow.
And we asked the school if we could put it up to train on, so they allowed us to do that. So that helped a lot, because then the timing and everything was quite different.
Yeah, I imagine it was. How were your travels and training financed? Did your family have to foot the bill? Or
yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because I think back then you had to be a true amateur. You couldn't be sponsored by anybody. So we had to pay for everything ourselves. So, and I saw a while back, I was looking through a scrapbook my father put together, and he saved everything, the plane ticket, you know, everything. So I looked at it, and to travel from round trip from Honolulu to Nebraska and back was $2,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And so that's why I only went like once or twice a year. I only went to indoor and outdoor nationals. I didn't go for meets in between because it was just way too expensive. And I'm the youngest of 5 children. And, you know, my mom was a teacher and my dad was a clerk. So it wasn't like we had, you know, a lot of money to spend. So it was quite expensive. I think they mortgaged the house at least 3 times, you know, just to finance my trip. And then my coach, of course, would say, okay, that dive was worth $30. You know, he had it down to how much each dive was worth. And I went, oh my God, really? You know, so it was one of those things that, okay, I got to do this because this is, you know, $30 down the tubes if I don't do it right. You know, but it was quite expensive and we were on a very, very strict diet. I mean, diet and as well as a budget diet, you know, and we paid for our coach as well, you know, and so it was, but he didn't charge us for lessons. So that was very helpful. And he was very young himself and he had a passion for it. So he was quite dedicated and my parents were as well. So I don't think I could have done it, you know, without all that kind of stuff going on.
Mm-hmm. What was your coach's name?
Wallace Nakamoto.
Oh, okay. Yes. I'm familiar with the name. Definitely.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
go ahead.
So that was in 66. Then in 67, we went to indoor-outdoor nationals. And I was getting progressively better with each one because we had gotten our own board. And I was practicing more on the 3-meter than before. And somewhere, I think it was about ninth grade or so, my coach said, you know, you're getting really good. You want to try for Olympics. And I said, okay. And I went home. Well, on the way home, I was sitting in the back of the car. And I said to my dad, I said, Dad, what's the Olympics? And he goes, you don't know what it is. I said, Dad, we don't have a TV. What the hell? You know? I don't know these things. You know, we live on this island here in the middle of the Pacific. And so he said, okay, well, okay, the Olympics is this really big diving meet with a lot of people come. That's all it really is. And I said, oh, okay, I can do that. I didn't know what I was saying at the time, because then we weren't going to practice 4 days a week. We were going to practice 6 days a week. And I thought, oh, that's 6 days a week. God, we got Sundays off. And so, and then before Olympic trials, we were training 7 days a week and sometimes twice a day, you know, and I kept saying, I said, this better be worth it, you know, because it's a hell of a lot of work, you know, and they said, well, don't worry about it. You know, we just got to keep working at it. So I said, okay. So by the time I got into 68, I was a junior in high school. And then went to Pittsburgh, I think, was indoor nationals. And I won the 1 meter and 3 meter, I think I came fourth. Then Olympic trials were a little bit after that in the summer. And Olympic trials, I think it was just before the summer. And I won the trials. And they had this big production where they put you on the telephone and you call home to tell your mom and dad that you won. So I had everybody listening. So they get the loudspeaker on and with me on the phone, and I go, Mom, I won the trial. She goes, oh, that's nice. I thought, oh, well, she's not too excited. So I said, put Dad on the phone. Puts Dad on the phone and go, Dad, I won. I'm first place. He goes, oh, good. And he went, okay, bye. Well, we'll see you when you get home. And I thought, and all the promoters, they said, well, Jesus Christ, that was uneventful. There's no screaming. There's no yelling. What's going on with this family? You know? So I hung up and everybody kind of looked shocked, like, okay, next person we're going to call. But when I got home, when I arrived home, then everybody was at the airport meeting me and all my friends and stuff. And I had Lays, you know, and all kinds of stuff. So it was, oh, okay. This is what I thought it was supposed to be. But I think in 68 Olympic Games, they were in Mexico City, but it wasn't until October. Uh-huh. It wasn't like in July, August. So, I was supposed to start school in September, my senior year of high school. But I wasn't going to be there. So my teachers, they all got together, got my homework assignments together and gave it to me before I left for training camp in Colorado Springs. And I thought, oh, geez, I have to do homework.
Oh.
I go, yeah. So, but you know what was really nice is because I was the youngest on the team. I had all these teammates were all older than me. So if I needed help, I had a lot of mentors there to help me out.
Oh, that's a good point.
I don't think I did too much homework, though, frankly. It was difficult to focus.
I'm sure it must have been.
Yeah. But my whole diving career, I was actually, before I got to Olympics, I was only diving about 6 years. Mm-hmm. And 4 years of kind of serious diving. So it was a blur to a large extent because, one, I didn't even know what the Olympics was before I went, other than it's this great big diving meet. You know, I didn't really realize the significance of it. And even when I got there, it was like, wow, this is a pretty big place. You know, look at all these people. It was like overwhelming in one sense. In another sense, it was like, okay, I got to go practice, you know, on all this other kind of stuff and meeting, you know, the team members. And I had kind of known them, but I really didn't get to know them that well while I was you know, training and the other meets, because you pretty much just focus on yourself, you know, and what you need to do. And then you, right after your event, for me, I had to run back home, you know, because it was too expensive to stay there any longer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was short and sweet, to the point. And I didn't take it all in. It wasn't until after it was over that I realized what actually happened. But while I was there, it was just a lot of things going on, and some of it I recognize, and others, some of it I had no idea of, like when Tommy Smith and John Carlos were doing their thing, and I had breakfast and lunch with them a couple times, and I still couldn't figure out what the hell they're upset about.
Oh.
And it was a huge thing. Everybody said it was huge. I went, really? And I said, well, I don't know. I had breakfast and lunch with them. They seem to be upset about something, about being black.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and I sat there and I listened to them, and I really couldn't grasp their issue, because in Hawaii, we have many colors. We have, you know, we have dark people, we have light people, we have Asians, we have Hawaiians. We don't distinguish between the different races as much, because we kind of all grew up together. And I myself have 8 different nationalities.
Oh, wow.
And my children have 12.
Oh, goodness.
So it's like, so what's the big deal? You know, you know, I'm Asian, I'm Hawaiian, I'm Caucasian, I'm German, I'm Spanish, you know, I'm all, you name it, I got it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't figure out why there was this big deal going on about being black,
mm-hmm.
and the civil rights movement and all that stuff. And, you know, it helps to have TV, which we didn't have. So I was really ignorant to a lot of the issues that were going on in the United States and the world, for that matter.
Mm.
You know, and I guess part of it is just being isolated, you know,
mm-hmm.
in an island. So I didn't have that kind of prejudice feeling about, or I didn't have a position one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And when I had lunch with them, and they invited me to have lunch with them, because I wasn't really black, I wasn't really white, I was kind of like in between.
Mm-hmm.
I was brown.
Mm-hmm.
And so they asked me to, you know, eat with them. I said, okay. And I sat there, and they were talking about black and discrimination and about civil rights. And I'm looking at them, I'm going, and I made a comment, which I don't think they appreciated, but I said, you know, if you felt that injustice to that extent, and if there was that much injustice in the United States, then you probably wouldn't be here. Because if in fact you were prejudiced to that extent, you wouldn't be on the team.
Hmm.
And they all looked at me like, what are you talking about? And I says, I'm not sure. I said, but I really don't understand what you're talking about, because I don't experience that where I'm from.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the type of prejudice we have here at the time was I didn't like you because you were Japanese, Chinese, Samoan, or Spanish. I didn't like you because I just thought, you know, you were we were not a nice person. It had nothing to do with your race.
Mm.
It had nothing to do with your ethnicity. It was just that if I thought you were nasty and mean, you were just nasty and mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't relate it to ethnicity or race.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I heard a lot of this, I couldn't relate to it. I couldn't understand it. And I kept saying, what's he bitching about? You know, because
mm-hmm.
I didn't have his experiences. You know, and when I did come to the mainland, it was pretty much all I saw was the pool in my room, you know, and then back on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you got there just before your event, you trained, you went to your room, you went to the pool, and then when it was done, bam, you went home. So I didn't experience too much of it. I did a little bit in Pittsburgh, but I did experience a little bit, but even that I couldn't understand. When I went into a restaurant to eat, they wouldn't serve me. And my girlfriend was white. My teammate was white, who I bunked with. And I kept saying, Sandy, I don't understand. Why are they taking other people before us? And I guess she wanted to be kind. She didn't say, well, they're just not paying attention. But it was because of me, because I wasn't white.
Interesting.
And then when they finally did take us, they put us in the corner, and then they didn't really serve us in a timely fashion.
Right.
And I kept saying, what's going on? I said, I don't understand. What's going on here? You know, I think I was about 15 at the time. And she never explained it to me, you know. And And even when I was at the Olympic Village, I was seeing this one boy from Jamaica, I think it was, and he was really dark. And people just stopped talking to me for a little while, and I couldn't understand that either. And they said, well, it's because of him. And I said, well, what about him? He goes, well, he's dark. I said, well, my brother is darker than him. So I don't see, I didn't understand all that stuff going on. And maybe it was good. I don't know. I don't know if it was or not.
Well, it's definitely
didn't come from the same perspective as everybody else.
Right. It's definitely an interesting perspective, a different one. Do you remember doing any preparation or training for the high altitude in Mexico City?
The only thing we did was we trained at Colorado Springs, up at the Air Force Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And we stayed there, you know, for a couple weeks there just to get used to the breathing and the altitude and all that other kind of stuff. And all I remember is workouts just took longer than normal because, you know, by the time you ran up to the 3 meter, you had to stop a little bit to breathe before you could go. But other than that, you know, it just took longer, you know, to get through stuff. Sometimes if you know, you get a little bit of lightheaded, a little bit of headache because you just weren't getting enough air. But, you know, you just slowed down and took a little bit longer.
And once you got to Mexico City and while you were competing, did you notice any effects from the high altitude during that time?
A little bit. But actually, when I was there, I got sick.
Oh.
From the water. They called it Montezuma's Revenge. I got very sick. But I kept training anyway, and I knew I wasn't feeling well. I knew things weren't going well. But the day after my event is when I think I got up to go to the bathroom and I just fainted.
Oh my gosh.
And I think I just held on long enough to get through it. And then once I got through it, my body just knew, okay, you don't have to do this right now. And it just sort of, all I remember is I blacked out. And then my roommate, Barbara Talmadge, I could hear her yelling, "Gal, gal!" And I'm going, you know, and I just kind of blacked out. And then I eventually woke up and I had the runs, you know, and I was not feeling well. And I was just, it was just one of those things that, you know, I had, what is going on? And when I came home, I was still sick, even after that. It took me quite a while to get over it because you get real dehydrated.
Yeah.
But I wasn't the only one. A lot of people got sick.
I've heard.
Up there. It's just the water. I mean, it's in the pool. It's everywhere. They cook the food in it. I mean, it's like you can't get away from it. You know, you brush your teeth. It's there.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the most sanitary place. And even our rooms were, I don't think the rooms were done. The floors were still cement. We slept in cots, which are really pretty small. So I felt sorry for the taller people. But it was not finished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when we got in there, it looked like it was still a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of Mexico City when you arrived there? What were your first impressions of the city itself and the people?
The people were nice. You know, I enjoyed that. I didn't realize poverty until I actually saw it. I saw children begging, and I'd never seen that before. I saw, the only thing I recollect is you were either poor or you were rich, but there was nobody in between. You either had a lot of money in a really nice house, or you lived in a mud hut. You know,
mm-hmm.
And there was, in essence, there was no middle class. You were rich or poor, and I'm not sure if it's changed all that much since then.
Mm.
I haven't been back there, but you know, I remember seeing that and feeling very fortunate that I was not living in that kind of situation, despite the fact that we didn't have a lot of money ourselves. We didn't live in that type of environment.
Mm-hmm.
So I came home with a renewed appreciation for my life, yeah, my family, that I didn't have to experience that. Culturally, it was very interesting. We went to see the pyramids and the museums, and it was quite interesting. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about people. And even at the village, I learned a lot about other countries and other people. And I came home with the idea that we're all pretty much the same. We just speak a different language.
That's a beautiful thought to take away. Do you remember hearing anything about student protests and violence in Mexico City in the weeks before the games opened?
I did. About one day we were riding, I'm not sure who was in the car with us, but we were coming, I think we were coming back to the village in somebody's car. And all of a sudden, in front of us jumped these, looked like, I don't want to say military, but there's somebody, they were dressed up and they had guns, and they stopped us, and everybody froze, and somebody in the car kept saying Estados Unidos, Estados Unidos, I mean United States, United States. And for a second there, we all just sort of froze, and then as fast as they appeared, they disappeared, and then we drove off. And I thought, what the heck was that? And I found out later there were these protests that were going on outside. But we weren't exposed to it all that much. And I didn't hear that much about it. And I didn't read the paper either, or, you know, try and figure out what was going on. But I did hear that there was some unrest that occurred while we were there. And that was about it. But I didn't get into any of the details of what it was about.
What were your impressions of the, well, you already told me a little bit about the Olympic Village, but what about like the food in the Olympic Village? What was that like?
The food wasn't something that I was used to. And although there was plenty of it, you know, it was always a buffet. It wasn't something that I was quite used to. And I think that's partly why we got sick too. I don't think if you ate the vegetables or something that was washed in their water, you were pretty doomed to be sick. Because the water wasn't all that clean. And I remember filling my glass up with water and seeing things swimming around in it. And I thought, what's the matter with this water? You know, But it was, for the most part, I think they did the best they could. I think the only, if I could go back and do it again, I think I'd only drink something in a bottle that had a cap on it, you know, and I'd be real careful. But it was not, you know, for us who weren't used to those kind of conditions, I think that did affect our health to a large extent. I think we could have done better if we, you know, a lot of us weren't sick. But, you know, some people still did well despite that.
Yeah. Were you particularly close with anyone on the team or with your roommate or suite mates?
Barbara Talmadge was kind of like my mom the whole trip over. I think she was older than most of the team members there. And she was kind of like bunked with me in the same room. So she was kind of, you know, okay, let's go over here. We're going this way. Okay, we're going that way. We have practice this time. So I think if it wasn't without her, I'd sort of be just wandering around. But she sort of kept an eye out on me, made sure, you know, I was okay and everything was going all right. So I never communicated with her after, but while we were there, she kind of took me under her wing, which I really appreciated. But later on, I realized, boy, that was really nice of her to do that. Mm-hmm. She was really, really sweet. I enjoyed her. She was a very, very nice person.
And what did you think of the event facilities where you practiced and later where you competed?
The venue we practiced at was huge. I had never been in a indoor pool that big. And it's pretty overwhelming for me, because I was just used to, you know, a smaller pool with the event. And I think the one thing that was stood out most of all was so many people were there to watch you. And the minute you started your dive, all these cameras went off. So you heard a click and you heard the running of these cameras. They were all filming you as you were walking down the board to do your approach. And I thought, boy, that's pretty annoying. But you had to learn to block that out and just do your dive. I think it was a little nerve-wracking at first, but it was the first time I had been in an event that was that big. because I had never dove internationally before, just at nationals. Mm-hmm. And there was never that many people there. I mean, there was people there, but not like thousands and thousands, like I was at the Olympics, which was a new experience for me.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most difficult thing for me was that my coach wasn't allowed to be my coach at the games.
Mm.
Because in 68, from what I understand, I don't know all the details, was the Olympic coaches were chosen, to accompany the team. And he was not chosen to be an Olympic coach. So when I left to go to training up at Air Force Academy, he couldn't come. And so the whole time between I went up almost until my event, I didn't have a coach. And all the other coaches tried to help me. They didn't understand my style and how I did things and, you know, what worked for me, what didn't. So I pretty much coached myself. And then the day before the games, my coach arrived and he had to sit up in the stands and just sort of kind of yell at me or give me hand signals on what to do. But by then it was pretty much too late, you know, to correct anything that, you know, I was doing wrong.
Hmm.
So as a result, I missed my first dive because my style had changed a little bit and I couldn't figure out what to do. And I think if I didn't miss my first dive, the outcome might have been different. But I think that was the one thing that was the most difficult for me is I didn't have a coach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, you know, that was just the rules at that point in time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not good or bad. It's just, it is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was not happy with it, but I wasn't about to let it bother me. I just thought, well, I'll just do the best I can.
Mm-hmm. You did amazingly well, all things considered.
Well, you know, I was ignorant of a lot of things, and maybe that was probably the best thing for me. I didn't know what Black Power was. I didn't know, okay, you don't have a coach now. You just have to deal with it. There was a lot of stuff I didn't know. And people would say to me, well, how'd you do that? And what do you think of this? I went, oh, I don't know. You know, is that a problem? Is that an issue? Oh, well, whose problem is it? You know, and I kept saying, and I thought, God, you must be really stupid. You don't know anything that's going on here. And people are getting upset. They're getting, you know, about this and that. And I'm going, why is everybody getting upset for? You know, and a lot of it was, I just really was not aware that things were supposed to be a certain way and they weren't.
Hmm.
And so I thought, well, it is what it is, you know. And get on with it. And even when I sat with Charlie Green and Carlos and Tommy Smith, I kept saying, I really don't understand why you guys are so upset.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you're here, aren't you? You won a medal, didn't you? You know. I said, so what are you bitching about? Jesus Christ, you know. And like I say, I didn't have the experiences that they did. So I couldn't put I really couldn't understand what the big deal was all about.
Mm-hmm. Well, was some of the questioning coming from the media? Did the media ask you any questions or interview you at any point?
Not when I was up there. I mean, when I came back, but the media down here was just focusing on what I did and not focusing on the Black Power salute and the civil rights, you know, issue and all that other kind of stuff. It wasn't till later that maybe some people would ask me about it. And I said, well, you know, it really wasn't an issue with me. I think it was more their issue. I said, it didn't affect me in any way. I'm glad that they did well. And, you know, I'm glad that people are aware of their plight. I said, but I'm not sure my feelings about it would change anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it didn't affect me. You know, but in some ways it did, but I didn't realize it till later, is I was kind of associated with the Black people because I wasn't white.
Mm.
And some of the team members, not just my team members, I'm not talking about mine, but some of the other U.S. team members didn't look upon me as being white and kind of categorized me with them. And as a result, was treated accordingly.
What do you mean by treated accordingly?
Well, in other words, if they had an issue with someone of darker color, they maintained that prejudice, and it was trans, and they associated me with them in that way. And so they wouldn't talk to me. They wouldn't acknowledge me, you know, as them. And I thought, well, that was pretty interesting, you know. Mm-hmm. But what I did was I started looking beyond my team, and I looked at other people who were there, like the Russians, for instance. They were a fun bunch, you know, to be with. When they were out in the public, they were very stern. But when they were in the bus with us, when nobody else was watching, they were really quite inquisitive. They were quite friendly, and they would ask the funniest questions, which I couldn't figure out where it was coming from. You know, so I looked beyond that, and I looked at other things that, you know, not to concern myself with, but, you know, to figure out what are all these people about.
Uh-huh.
And I remember being on the bus one day going to the pool, and two Russian boys sat in the back of me, and they tapped me on the shoulder, and they asked me, "Do you have a refrigerator?" I looked at them, and I went, and I thought, well, that was an odd question. And I thought, yeah, I have a refrigerator, and guess what? We even have one in the garage to hold the beer. And they just laughed, and they were like, "Oh my God, really? You have two refrigerators?" You know, and they would ask silly questions like that. And I thought, what the hell's that about? You know, and they would ask all these kinds of questions. Well, what's it like living in the United States? I said, well, I don't really live in the United. I live in the United States, but I live on this island in the middle of the Pacific, so it is a little different. I said, but in some ways it's not. I said. And they said, "Do you have a car?" I said, "Yeah, we have a car." And oh my God, they were so impressed. We have a car, you know. We have a refrigerator. We have a car, and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I thought, this is really funny. But when we were out in the public, like at the pool, they didn't talk to you. They acted like a totally different person. When we were in a bus where it was only athletes or in a closed situation, they were a completely different person altogether. Okay. Very friendly, very inquisitive, you know, and just funny.
Mm-hmm.
You know, funny to be with. They were great fun.
Why were they different when they were in public?
I asked him one other thing. He goes, well, because they're watching us. And I figured out later was that there might have been some government officials that were watching to make sure none of them defected. So they had to be on their toes when they're out in public. But in private, where nobody was allowed onto the bus except the athletes, then they could be a little more open.
Hmm.
You know, but I did notice a stark difference in their behavior when they're in the open as opposed to when we were in a little more closed situation, like in the bus, where nobody else was allowed unless you were an athlete.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So
I think at one point in time, you know, there was some worry that some of the athletes might defect, and so they had people watching them to make sure that, you know, that wouldn't happen. I'm not sure how they were going to stop it, but they were very careful about their behavior.
Very interesting. Well, do you remember any other interactions with Soviet bloc athletes, or any particular interactions with athletes from other countries?
I do recall, I think, a track runner who was from Jamaica, I believe, but he trained in the United States. He went to college in the United States, but he was representing Jamaica because it's his home country. And I thought, oh, you can do that? You know, I didn't know you could do that. He goes, yeah. And I said, oh, how interesting. And then I met some of the other athletes from Italy, and they're a friendly bunch, and from Europe. In fact, I met this one girl from Poland, and in the village, we were trading all kinds of stuff. You traded pins, you traded your bag, you know, for their bag and all that kind of stuff. And I got carried away, and I traded away my sweats for sweats from Poland, which was white with red lettering. And when it came down to the finals and I found out that I won third place, they said, okay, put your sweats on. We got to go on the podium. I went, oh, crap. And I said, well, gee, I forgot mine. And I couldn't go up with the Poland one. So somebody said, here, borrow hers or his. So I borrowed somebody's sweatshirt, but I couldn't find pants. So I had to go on the podium only with the shirt on and not the sweatpants because I couldn't find it. So, in fact, I didn't even know I won third place. When it was over, I was ready to go home because I really wasn't feeling well. I was very sick. And they said, no, you can't go. I think you won. I went, no, I don't think so. I'm just going to go home. I got to go to bed. I don't feel good. So when they figured out the points, I was tied with the Russian girl, and she beat me by like 0.23. I said, okay, you know, you've got to go, you know, drop your stuff, go put your sweats on. I went, I don't have sweats. So that's when I borrowed. But then we had to do the drug test. They took us to that was the most humiliating experience for me because they actually watched you. At least they watched me.
Wow.
And I went into the bathroom, and you know, you only have your suit on. And so to pee into the bottle, you got to drop your suit down to your knees. And of course, and then you're naked.
Oh no.
And I was 17, you know, freezing. And my mother didn't even watch me pee. And so, and then the opening of the bottle, I swear to God, was the size of a dime. And so you're supposed to catch your pee into this little bottle. And so in between your legs, well, somebody watches you. I guess they were afraid that I might, you know, sneak in somebody's urine or sample, I guess. I couldn't figure that one out. And I went, why do I have to pee in this bottle? And, you know, and didn't dawn on me that they were doing, you know, drug testing. And so it took me forever. It would seem forever to get pee into the bottle. And so I finally, and you had to do so much for them to test it, you know, couldn't be two drops. And, but no, the female, I don't know, attendant watched me as I peed into the bottle. It was a visual inspection. And I kept telling her, can you turn around? She went, no, I don't even know if she spoke English. And so I thought, okay, it felt like I was there for an hour. I'm sure it wasn't. But at any rate, when my bladder was about to burst is when I peed. And I finally got a few drops in there, and then I handed it off to her. Most of it got on my hand. And I handed it back to her because I'd never done that before. And then I guess they did a quick test. And then they marched us off to the podium, and, you know, the rest was just procedure. But it was that was an interesting experience. They said, what was the most memorable thought? And I always want to say the drug test, but when I was doing the media, I said something else. But that stands out in my mind very vividly.
I'm sure.
And even when my mom said, what took you so long? I said, Mom, I have to pee into a bottle. She goes, why? I went, I don't know. No, they never told me why. They just said, here, they handed me the bottle, shoved me in the bathroom, and somebody stood there and watched me. You know, I said, I don't know what the hell that's about.
Did your coach ever talk to you about drug testing or about banned substances or anything like that?
Nope. You know, and if he did, I wasn't paying attention.
Yeah.
But, you know, I heard that they were testing. But they were testing for if you were on – I heard they were testing if you're a guy or a girl. Was because if you took so much steroids, you're you know, it came out that you weren't a girl anymore. You're actually a guy. And it was kind of interesting because the European girls were very manly, you know, and what didn't help it any is they didn't shave, you know, their arms or their legs. So it was like, and I kept thinking, I saw this one woman in the bathroom. I came out of the stall and she was shaving her face. I thought, oh God, I'm in the wrong bathroom. Shit. You know, what am I going to do? Oh crap. I'm in the men's bathroom. And I thought, wait a minute. No, I'm not. You know, there's no urinals in here. And I walked out and I walked out to the front of the bathroom and made sure I was in the women's bathroom, not the men's. And I said, yeah, I'm in the women's. I said, why the hell is she shaving her face? You know, it's just from Czechoslovakia or something. And then I was hearing they were doing what they call the cheek test, where they rub the like the popsicle stick on your cheek to test. And one was a high jumper, they said, was actually tested as a male and not a female, or something to that effect. I mean, I think that was the one that was in the bathroom shaving, you know, but it was quite, everything was so new to me. And it was like, I don't understand what's going on here. You know, why do I have to pee in this bottle? Nobody told me about this, you know. You know, and I'm sure they said, well, they're going to test for drugs, but I didn't know what that meant.
Okay.
You know, I really didn't know what that really meant. That means you have to pee in a bottle and they do this and this and that. I just heard, well, they're testing. Okay. But they didn't tell me what was, you know, the details involved in that and what you had to go through.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I guess I wasn't even thinking that far ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no expectations of how I was going to do. I was going to just do the best I could, and I was going to go home.
Mm-hmm.
That was all I was going to do. But and maybe that was a good thing too, because if I expected to win, I would have probably put more pressure on myself than I really needed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe so. So since your family didn't have a TV, did any of them come to the Olympics to watch you, or were they able to watch you on TV back home?
Well, my mom and dad actually couldn't afford to come because they'd spend so much money sending me to these trips. They really did. They couldn't afford it. And so they weren't going to come, and there was no expectation that they were going to come. So somehow or another, there was a fundraiser back home, and they raised enough money to send my mom and dad. I think my brother was in college in California. I think he came as well. But they arrived the day before my event and surprised me, which was a really, really nice surprise to see them, because I hadn't seen them for about 6 weeks.
Mm.
And my mom said to me when I went to see her after I dove, before my event, she goes, "Aren't you a little close, honey?" See, my mom had never, ever seen me dive before the Olympics. Because she was taking care of the other four kids at home.
Oh.
And I went to school and I dove in town, and we lived on the other side of the island. So actually, she never really saw me dive until I got to the Olympics. And then when she saw me, she goes, "Wow, you're kind of close. You should move it out a little bit." My dad's going, "Don't tell her that." I said, "No, I think I'm okay, you know." And so she said, "Well, I don't think I can watch." And so my dad says, "You better watch. This is because, you know, this is where we are." And so it was quite an experience for her as well. But otherwise, if there wasn't some really good people involved back at home, you know, financing their trip, they would not have been able to come.
Mm-hmm. She was afraid you were too close to the board.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they had never come to any of my national meets either.
Oh.
Because they couldn't afford it. So the only one was my dad came to the first one because my coach couldn't come, so he accompanied me.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, all the other national meets I went to, they couldn't come, you know, to see how I did because it was just too expensive.
Mm-hmm. And you said you had four brothers and sisters back home. How many siblings did you have total?
I had two older brothers and two older sisters.
Mm. And what did
and so they go ahead?
I was just going to ask what they thought of your diving and your being at the Olympic Games.
I think they were quite proud. They were in the traditional sports line. My brothers played football and basketball, you know, and those kinds of things. And you know, diving was like not even a sport to them. It was like, well, you know, this is something she does. She jumps off the board. So, and they were quite good at their sports. You know, my two brothers were like captain of the team and the quarterback and, you know, all state and in the state meet, you know. So they had all their trophies lined up, you know, on the bookshelf and the mantle. And when it got to me, there wasn't any room for any of my accolades. So my brother, somebody put a shoebox at the bottom, the base of the, and he says, "Here, put all your stuff in here." So all my medals and stuff ended up in the shoebox. And they still didn't think that what I did was equal, to what there was, because it was like, well, what's diving? You know, is that a sport really? You know, so, and I rose so quickly, you know, I really didn't start diving till like 64, 65. And so in a very short period of time, I was in the Olympic Games. So, and they were older and they were out of school by then. And, you know, I'm pretty sure they were pretty proud of me. But it was, they didn't, never made a big deal of it. Mm. And even when I came home, they went, "Hey, you did good." I went, "Yeah, I did, I think." But I still, my shoebox never made it to the top mantle. It still stayed at the bottom. So there's a pecking order here.
So what are your memories of the opening ceremony?
All I remember is somebody saying, when they let the birds out, put your purse on your head. Because the birds have been cooped up so long, they just let loose. And so you don't want to get hit. So that's what that somebody standing next to me said, "Oh God, there goes the birds. Put your, you know, cover your head." That's all I remember. I remember being hot, and I remember being, it was a very inspiring event for me, because we were marching in with all the other teams, and it was other countries, you know, and marching around the stadium and just seeing all this fanfare was like, wow, you know. My dad told me this is just a big event, but it's a lot bigger than that, you know, because he told me it's just a big diving meet, a lot of people come. And I thought, no, this is more than this, that this is something else entirely different. And so like I say, it was quite overwhelming, all this that was going on. And what was all this big fanfare about? You know, this is just a diving meet. Mm-hmm. You know, why all the big deal? You know, but I realized, you know, the athletes there were quite extraordinary. And I didn't really relate to me as being extraordinary. I just related to being, you know, I love diving and this is why I'm here. And that's all. Mm-hmm. You know, no expectations other than I really like what I do. And, you know, all the American athletes, we were all amateurs. You couldn't do commercials. You know, you couldn't do any kind, you couldn't have sponsors, you couldn't do commercials, because then you'd be considered a professional. Mm-hmm. So I think back then the perspective was, we did it because we loved it, and this is something that we were really good at. Athletes today, I'm sure love it, and I'm sure, but there's an incentive behind it. You know, this can be your career. You can actually have, there's some financial gains. Mm-hmm. If you do really well. You could do a Wheaties commercial or whatever, you know, and you can make a lot of money. Whereas in Mexico, you know, you didn't have any of that. So everybody that was there for the purpose of, to do the best they could, to show that they were the best than anybody else, and because they loved it. Mm-hmm. And once they professionalized it, because everybody else was professionals, it changed a little bit of how you perceived yourself, you know, in your sport, in your event. There was a lot more incentive, you know, to do better. Like if you broke a world record, you might have gotten a cash prize. Hmm. Whereas if I won, you know, I won the nationals and they gave me roses. Hmm. And that was it.
Yeah.
You know? Roses and a medal, and they sent you home. You know, whereas now is if you win, then you get a trip to on the European tour or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can get all that other kind of stuff. Whereas back then, I got roses and congratulations, and here's your medal, and bye.
Very different.
Yeah.
How do you yeah. feel about that? What are your feelings about the change?
In some ways, I think it's good because, you know, you could only go to one or two at the very most because it's too expensive to finance it on your own. And whereas now is where you have some financial incentives, you can go for two or three and maybe more, you know, because you could train, you know, because that's your job. Whereas before, it wasn't your job. It was something you did because you liked it. You know, unless your family was independently rich and they could provide all that for you, it was very, very difficult. You know, most of us had to come home and continue school and go to work because we racked up all these bills, you know, just trying to get there. Mm-hmm. It was very hard on my family. It was very hard financially, and they sacrificed a lot. you know. But they do it all over again, you know. And so you felt a need to not let them down, because they did really, they sacrificed a lot. So you had to do your end too and make sure that, you know, you put your best foot forward.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, you know, you could be financed, you know, and not worry about having to go to work or having to do anything else. You could just train,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you quite different.
Yeah, very different. You mentioned sacrifice and having to do your part. Did you ever feel, I know you loved the sport, but did you ever feel that you were missing out on other things in life because of training and competing and diving?
In some ways I did, you know, because I had to scale back on any type of social activity that I wanted to engage in and give my full attention to training, you know, which meant you had to be in bed by a certain time. You had to eat certain foods. You know, you couldn't go out, you know, on the weekend with your friends, you know, and stay out late and because you had to wake up early the next morning and go to practice. So, you know, I think in high school, I only went to 4 dances, which was my freshman dance, my sophomore dance, my freshman dance, and my senior prom. And that was it. That was the extent of my social involvement. And so I think to a large extent, for me only, I was kind of a social misfit because all I did was train. You know, and all the other girls had gone through all these other social growths. You know, they had boyfriends and they broke up, and then they had social gatherings, and I couldn't participate in that. So in a lot of ways, socially, you know, I was kind of stunted in my growth. And I think a lot of athletes are, who train constantly. You don't have that opportunity to go through that normal childhood, you know, development that most people do, because you definitely are focused on your, you know, on your sport. And it's necessary. There's really no way around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't do all that stuff and train too.
Right.
There's just no time. So you have to make a choice.
Hmm. Well, while you were at the games, did you get to go to any of the other events and witness any world records being set or anything like that?
I did get to see a couple of volleyball games because most of the members on the volleyball team were actually from Hawaii.
Mm.
Most of the half of the women and half of the men actually on the volleyball team were from Hawaii. So I was able to, when they were done, I was able to go over to their room and, you know, kind of talk with them a little bit and celebrate with them. They didn't do as well as they would have liked to, but you know, it was familiar faces. They were older than I was, but it was really nice. There was one guy on the swim team, and I think the majority of the volleyball team was actually from Hawaii.
Oh, that's interesting.
And one of the guys who's from Hawaii, his son now is on the volleyball team for the Olympics. Clay Stanley. He's on the volleyball team. His dad, John, and I were on the same Olympics. So it's kind of nice to see, you know, his son doing so well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, are there any other memorable events or experiences that you remember that either you witnessed or happened to you during the games?
I met a couple people that were... One guy I met, I forget where he's from, Argentina, somewhere in South America. For some reason, I don't know what his problem was, but after we had only met for an hour, he wanted to marry me. I thought, what the hell are you talking about? And I went, no, I don't think so. My father would not approve of this. And he goes, you sure? I went, yeah, I'm positive. You know, it was just so strange, you know. And I came back with a lot of kind of different experiences, and a lot even more after, where I would get a lot of people writing to me after the games wanting me to come and visit them in different countries. And I thought, why? You know, and I thought, what? I'm the same person I was before I left, and I'm the same person now. Why am I being viewed in a different light? You know, why am I, quote, so special?
Had these...
I couldn't... I couldn't figure that one out.
Had these people seen pictures of you or media footage of you?
I think they had watched the games on TV, and for some reason, I was getting mail from people in Europe and Japan and all over the place, wanting to know more about me. And in Oxford, I got a letter from these boys from Oxford wanting me to come and visit them. And then a lot of speaking engagements and a lot of appearances. And I kept saying to my mom, I go, Mom, what's going on? I'm the same person I was when I left. She goes, well, it's because you went to the Olympics. And I kept saying, Anne? She goes, well, not a lot of people go there. And I said, well, I understand that, but I'm still the same person. I said, what do they want to know? This is, they want to know who you are. And I went, but I'm, you know, and I guess because I was so young, and my exposure to just what anything beyond Hawaii was very, very limited.
Mm-hmm.
And my family sure as heck didn't put me on a pedestal. So I couldn't figure out why everybody else was. You know, I kept saying, what's the matter with these people? And it was nice being treated that way. It was very nice. And it opened up a lot of doors for me that would not have opened up for me, you know, getting jobs. You know, when I went to... Every job I went to put in to work at, I got hired. And I thought, well, this is pretty easy. And then I realized later it wasn't because I was really good at what it was because of who I was and how they remembered me, you know. So the advantages of, you know, being in that type of forum paid off tremendously for me. Otherwise, if I had not done that, I probably wouldn't have as many opportunities as I had. You know, and I didn't realize, I thought, wow, they really like me. And I thought later on, it's not because of that. It was because you went to the Olympics. And the problem with that is there's an expectation that you're above everybody else, or you're smarter than everybody else, or you know more than everybody else. So then there's this expectation you have to live up to that sometimes is not realistic.
Hmm.
You know, like you can't make mistakes because you're kind of perfect.
Hmm.
Or because you went to the Olympics, you're a special person, so you're better. And so there's those kinds of things that you have to deal with, you know, and I'm sure the Olympians of today have that as well. They have you under a microscope. If you go take a drink in a bar, it's in the front page.
Exactly.
Or something. Yeah. So, living in a bubble is not real fun, you know, but... And that just comes along with it.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to deal with it and, you know, hopefully be an example to those younger ones coming up.
Well,
there's a lot more to it than just performing.
Right. Well, speaking of that, what advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
I think the first thing I would say to it is do it because you love it. You know, don't do it because other people want you to do it. Don't do it because you think you could make a lot of money. The first thing you got to do is you got to love it. And because if you don't, you're eventually going to hate it. And then you're going to blame everybody for, you know, for your misfortunes. And so that's the first thing you got to have, because if nothing else works out, at least you love it. And it's a passion.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you don't have a passion for it, it's not going to get you through the many hours of training. It's not going to get you through all the media attention that they have upon you. It's not going to help you in any way or form if you don't like it. And that's probably the most important thing. You got to love it, because if you don't love it, then you're not going to want to train, you know, an extra hour or two. You're not going to want to get out of bed on a Sunday morning to go work out, you know, because you just don't care for it all that much. And if it doesn't start there, chances are you're not going to be very good at it. Or you're going to resent the fact that, you know, you have to do something you really don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably, you know, my only advice that I'd give anybody is, if you don't have that, then you should go find something else to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's really good advice. So do you remember the closing ceremony, or were you there for the closing ceremony?
No, I wasn't there. Sue Gossick, who won the 3-meter,
mm-hmm.
said, Kayla, let's go to Acapulco. And I went, okay. So we made arrangements. We left before the closing ceremonies, and off we went, You know, I had no idea that there was a closing ceremonies. Now, if somebody had said, you know, don't you want to be here for the closing ceremonies where there's this big party? I probably would have said, yeah, I'd rather do that. But I didn't. So we ran off to Acapulco, and my mom and dad followed, you know, soon thereafter and, you know, met us there. But we stayed in this dingy hotel next to this bull ring. You know, it's like B-rated, C-rated, you know, bullfight. And the bullfighters actually stayed in the same hotel that we did. And I felt so bad for them because, you know, if they had a bad day with the bull run, they'd come, they'd drag themselves in, you know, with a not in very good shape, you know. And
yeah.
I thought, oh, these poor guys, you know. And I went to one bullfight and I was cheering for the bull,
yeah.
You know, because I thought, oh, don't do that to that poor bull.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't something that was enjoyable for me. But yeah, we went up to Acapulco and then from there I came home.
Mm.
But it was quite an experience, quite an experience. If I had to do it over again, I would have, if I was going to another Olympics, I would have stayed longer to, you know, gain more experience as to what the Olympic experience is all about. I would have enjoyed it a lot more had I known.
Mm. So, what was your return home like? What was your reception like?
It was, I had all my classmates from high school meet me at the airport, all my family, and a big banner, and I had Lay's, you know, up to my neck, and it was like, it was amazing. I thought, oh my gosh, all these people are here for me. And I couldn't figure out what all the attention was about, you know. And it was, everybody was really proud of me and happy for me. And I was proud that I represented my state, Hawaii, and I represented the United States as well as I could. And I thought it was important that I'd be a good example for those that wanted to aspire to the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I tried very hard to set a good example for those people who wanted them. And I tried to be a good example for Hawaii too as well.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, you know, we're a pretty small state. You know, we don't have a lot of people here. But interestingly enough, we have a lot of people who do go to the Olympics on occasion.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big accomplishment for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, what happened with your athletic career after the 68 games? Can you summarize or describe the highlights?
After the games, I did a lot of appearances. I actually finished high school and I went to college here. And then I decided, you know, I needed to take a break. And I got married soon after.
Hmm.
And then I had a child. And then I thought, well, gee, maybe I should try again. So I tried for the Munich Games mm-hmm. in 72, but I just couldn't do it because I had to work.
Hmm.
You know, I had to work and train at the same time, and I was going to school. And it was just too hard. I couldn't put the time in, and I was tired. I mean, I went to trials, and I didn't do very well. But I thought, okay, you know, at least I tried. But because I had to work and I had all these other responsibilities, I just wasn't able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it cost, you know, it just cost too much
right.
to try and finance that. So I did stop after the 72 games, and I kept involved with diving here, you know, as an official and as a coach. You know, I coached for many years after, and kept in touch a little bit, but mainly just kept involved with the sport, and I still am to a small extent now, not as much as before.
Mm-hmm.
But it was too difficult financially to try and do that. So that was probably the biggest reason why I didn't do as well as I could have. I just couldn't focus my attention on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are your thoughts about Title IX, and if Title IX had passed, you know, in 65 instead of much later? How do you think that might have affected your diving career?
I'm not sure if it would have had an effect at all. I think Title IX took a while for it to really get going and really showed some promise. know, and by the time 68 was around, it was still, I don't think it was significant enough to make a difference as it is today. Because my two daughters, if it hadn't been for Title IX, might not have gotten scholarships, you know, to go to college. My older daughter got a scholarship for volleyball, and as well as my younger daughter. And I think if Title IX hadn't been around, they would not have had that opportunity you know, to go to school for a sport. And so I think it helped them. But when I was diving, I don't think it had matured enough to help me. Yeah. So, but it definitely helped them.
Was your diving a factor at all in your going to college or getting accepted to college?
It might have been. I did dive for the UH for 1 year at a diving meet. I did it 1 year, and then I just couldn't do it after that. I says I can't continue this because, you know, I've got to work. I've got to dive. You know, I got to study. I says I can't do all of this and do a good job too. So I did try 1 year, but it didn't work out. So I realized, okay, I have to focus on moving on. So I did.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not, you know, disappointed that it turned out that way. Because, you know, I had no expectation of even going to the Olympics when I was younger. I had no idea what it was. And even when I made the team, I still didn't know what it was, you know, what was such a big deal about it. I kept thinking, it's just a diving meet. What's everybody excited about?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, in your opinion, what was the impact or the significance of the 68 games to the world?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, from what I read, it was the first games that was at that altitude, and I don't think they should ever do that again. And it was the first games where they did drug testing, which I'm glad they are doing. And I think it was, you know, it brought to light the civil rights movement, which is, I think, is important, you know, not just for the United States, but for the world in general. You know, the world didn't take it very well, but I think that's true of anything when it's brought to your attention. You know, people don't want to look at it, you know, until they finally do. I mean, what's so amazing right now is we have a president that is of that ancestry. In fact, his classmate is my niece. They went to school together at Punahou. And that's where I went to school, at Punahou. You know, and so we've come a long way in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
A very, very long way. We've made incredible strides in a lot of different areas. And there's a lot more to be done. But, you know, from 1968 to now, we went from what I understand, there was riots in Watts and all over the place. There was a lot of civil unrest to having a president, you know, he's from Hawaii, but he's part black. That's pretty amazing. You know, so I think although people didn't appreciate it at the time, I think when they look back at it now, it's not such a big deal anymore. You know, I think I didn't realize that the Soviet bloc athletes, you know, there was a large presence there, but I didn't realize that was a big deal either. You know, and everybody kept saying, well, what about the Soviets and what about the Russians? And they were bad people. And I thought, no, they're not. They're just like us. You know, in fact, even at school when I came home, you know, there was this impression that Russians were bad people. And I thought, well, no, I met a couple. They're pretty nice. You know, so I'm not sure what you're talking about, you know, and so there's a lot of misconceptions that I walked away with a totally different perspective altogether, you know, so for me, it was a good thing, you know.
Well, before we wrap up the interview, is there anything else that you'd like to tell us about?
I think I just about said everything. I think I'm most appreciative of the fact that, you know, I was blessed to be in a position. I was in the right place at the right time with the right people. You know, I had amazing parents. I had a tremendous coach. I had a community here that just supported me, you know, beyond all belief. And I feel really, really lucky and blessed to have had all of that. And being afforded the opportunity to represent the United States and to represent Hawaii the way I did. In a way, I'm glad I didn't realize what I was doing, you know, but I look back on it now to see how fortunate I was. And I'm just very thankful and I'm very blessed. You know, and that's pretty much, you know, all I really have to say about that. I think if I hadn't gone to the Olympics, my life would be very different.
How do you think it would be different?
Well, I don't think I would have had as many opportunities, and not that it's not a good thing, but I don't think I would have had the opportunities that I've had in my life. I know my life would not be the same. I'm not sure if it would be better or if it'd be worse, but I know it would not be the same. You know.
Well, thank you so much for doing this interview. And on behalf of the project, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today. And I very much enjoyed it. I'm going to go ahead and stop the recorder now.